Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood of CNBC, and this is On Point. Today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day, when we celebrate the birth of a man who led the modern civil rights movement and lost his life for it. And yet, here we are, 50 years after King's assassination, and the President of the United States is being called a racist. Here we are, struggling to even have a conversation about race. We'll talk with the author, Ijeoma Oluo, who has strong views and a new book on the subject. This hour, On Point, talking about race in America today. You can join us on air or online. With feelings rubbed raw by President Trump, should we talk more about race or less? Are the volatile politics of the last year changing the conversation in your neighborhood or your office? Now, joining me now from Seattle is Ijeoma Oluo. She is the editor-at-large of The Establishment, a media platform run and funded by women. Her book, So You Want to Talk About Race, comes out tomorrow. Ijeoma, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Let me start, Ijeoma, with a quote from an article that you wrote 2 years ago on Martin Luther King Day, I believe, 2016. And get you to explain it, because it's a provocative statement. You said, "The Martin Luther King Jr. that we celebrate every year is no longer a man or a movement. The annual holiday is no longer a remembrance. Like the creation of the Christmas holiday to pacify, assimilate, and eventually control pagan populations by twisting their sacred truths into brightly colored lies, the narrative of the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, along with the oversimplified whitewashed chapters of civil rights history only opened in schools during this week and the month of February, works to distract and weaken black Americans while strengthening white supremacy." Why do you feel that way?
I feel there are a lot of other scholars as well who talk about the Santa Clausification of Martin Luther King, of taking, you know, one snippet of one speech and turning it into all the man was. And Dr. King was, of course, a very brilliant man with a lot of really amazing actionable ideas around race and justice in this country. And what I have seen and many others have seen is that this holiday has turned into talking just about how peaceful he was, how loving he was, how kind he was, in a way to kind of encourage Black Americans to be more passive in their activism. It doesn't mean that I think there shouldn't be a holiday or that the man should not be remembered. I think he is an amazing human who should be remembered every single day. But I think we need to remember who he actually was and what he actually said, instead of just what suits kind of the powers that be for us to talk about.
Well, you wrote that column as Barack Obama was entering his eighth and final year in the presidency. 2 years later, we now have Donald Trump as president. Does the fact of the Trump presidency and what we've seen during this past year, does that change any way that you see this holiday in the American context? Does it mean something different now?
I think we're seeing very much the same thing. It's just louder and a lot more empowered. But I actually find a lot of similarities to the ways in which Dr. King was treated in his day and referred to the same way in which Black Lives Matter activists are treated today. And there was a lot of the same rhetoric that, you know, he was too demanding, that he was inciting violence, that, you know, he was asking for too much. And we hear a lot of that today. And I think what we're seeing is that same dialogue being emboldened now that someone actually kind of ran on that platform in order to become president.
Now, it's so soon after the Obama presidency that any judgments that we make now are likely to be revised by historians. But from your perspective, what effect did the fact of Obama's election as the first African-American president, the way in which he conducted his presidency, both in terms of his style and manner and his policies. What effect do you think that we will look back and say that had on American race relations?
You know, it will depend, I think, how these next few years turn out. But I do think that it galvanized a crisis point that we were reaching in race relations. I think that during a lot of the 80s and 90s, we kind of had this myth that things were going pretty well. We had kind of this Cosby family dream of black middle class success. And then what we saw with the recession was that, no, that was not true. And once again, people of color, black people, indigenous people, Latinx people were left with nothing at the end of that. And I think what we saw here was as Obama, you know, rose to power and became the face of our highest office, it caused a moment of crisis for people who had thought that they had sorted out all of their racial issues, especially white Americans. And what we're seeing right now is kind of the aftermath of that crisis, of what it looks like when, for the first time in your entire life, the president of the United States doesn't look like what you expected him to look like. And I think kind of there's this rush to reclaim things before it's too late. How I think that was inevitable. I think this would have happened whether or not Obama had been elected. It may have happened a few years later, but it still would have happened. And I think what we'll see now is whether or not we can push through this crisis into something better.
Let me step back for a minute and just get a little personal history from you so that viewers can understand how you came to have the voice and perspective that you have, where you come from. I imagine from your name that your ancestry traces to perhaps Kenya, somewhere in Africa. Is that correct?
In Nigeria. Yes.
Nigeria. Okay. First of all, what was your reaction to the comments attributed to President Trump over the weekend when he was referring in a vulgar and negative way about countries in Africa?
It was absolutely no surprise to me. I mean, he's been treating us like that's what he thinks about us since far before the election. You know, he was saying that Nigerians live in huts. I was not surprised at all. It was almost kind of amusing to watch the shock that a lot of white Americans had, because he didn't even have to say that to know that that's what he felt. If you're a person of color in this country, that's how you've been treated from the moment this administration, well, since the moment that Trump really started seriously running.
Now, so tell me about your life, where you were born, what kind of family you grew up in, and your evolution in thinking on this subject.
Certainly. I am a mixed-race black woman. I was born in Denton, Texas, and my father came here from Nigeria to pursue a college degree, and he met my mom, and they fell in love. It's almost the Barack Obama story, only
sounds
nobody
like
became
it.
President in the end.
Yeah. Well, you've still got time.
My brother and I were born, and then my father went back for the coup in 1982 and stayed and died when I became older. And my mom raised the two of us in Seattle. She moved to Seattle when we were about 2 years old, and we were raised here. And we were extremely poor, at times homeless. And she raised us to be as proud of our black heritage as a white mom could provide us with. And we grew up here kind of always being, you know, the odd ones out. We were almost always the only black kids in our class. I got a degree in political science. I have always been fascinated with our society and kind of combining it with looking at our history. And I was raising two boys and kind of doing what I needed to do to pay bills. But what I realized was I really couldn't avoid talking about these issues that meant so much to me and my children and my community.
You were not working in the field of public policy or politics. This is something that came to you in the course of your life as you were holding down a regular job.
Definitely. Yeah. I was working in tech like just about everyone else in Seattle does. And so I was working in marketing. And, you know, it was one of those things where I started to realize that this was taking over my whole life. Of course, I was scared for the safety of my brother out in the streets when he was driving around. I was scared for the safety of my children and for people I loved. And I would go to the office and no one would talk about it. It was like it didn't exist.
Now, you described in your book a breakthrough conversation that you had with your own mother, which I found fascinating. Let our viewers in on that. our listeners in on that. Sorry.
You know, it was really interesting because my mom did make a very conscious effort as we were growing up to really make sure that we were proud of our blackness and of our Nigerian heritage. So she would dress us up, make us go to school in like full galas and full outfits. And she worked really, really hard to instill that on us. But it was still from the, you know, viewpoint of a white American. And she talked to us about staying safe around cops and security guards and things like that. But she still, you know, it still wasn't something when we sat around the dinner table that we talked about very often. And I guess I had always kind of assumed that my mom got most of it. That she just got it kind of through osmosis, through reading my work. And it wasn't until a couple of years ago that my mom called me on the phone as she had had an uncomfortable conversation with someone at work about race. And she wanted to share this with me that I realized that we really hadn't had some really substantive conversations on race and racial identity that we really needed to have. And
did so you think your mom had handled it well, the conversation with her coworker?
I think that she had handled it with the best of intentions, and I think that she didn't handle it incredibly poorly. She didn't let her emotions get away with her. But she handled it in a way that surprised me, because it was a way that I have encountered a lot of white people handling this conversation with this kind of implied, you must already know that I get this. How could you not know that I'm not racist? How could you not know that I understand? And it was kind of shocking because I've done so much work around that and getting people to understand, you know, what privilege and race looks like in day-to-day conversations, to realize that my mom hadn't recognized that. But then I realized, well, you know, we actually haven't really had our own conversation about it.
That's fascinating. Ijeoma, hold that thought. We're discussing race in America today. You can join the conversation. Are we making progress against racism, or are we sliding back? How do you feel? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm John Harwood. This is On Point. And as we go to break, here's the song Very Black by Jamila Woods featuring artist No Name.
Tell me no more lies. You're serving and protecting and stealing babies' lives.
I'm very black, black, black. And send me back, back, back. You take my brother, brother, brother. I fight back, back, back.
I'm very black, black, black. I made a back, back, back. You take my brother.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Hey, it's Maria Hinojosa, host of NPR's Latino USA, the podcast that takes you inside the Latino conversation. Each week, we'll take you into one story that will fascinate and often surprise you. Listen to Latino USA on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Don't touch my hair.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, and that was Solange singing Don't Touch My Hair off her 2016 album A Seat at the Table. We're talking about race in America today. You can join the conversation. Does the MLK holiday make you stop and think and do anything, or is it just another day off? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with Ijeoma Oluo. She's the author of So You Want to Talk About Race. And Ijeoma, let me just start this segment by asking you, what do you hope readers get from your book? What is your principal message?
I would say that my principal message is that you will find opportunities in your day-to-day life to do things that will have a real measurable impact on systems of oppression if you start listening to other people and start asking the right questions. I think that we oftentimes forget that we talk so that we can identify opportunities. And in discussions of race, there is a lot of opportunity to find out how every day you are either contributing to a system of oppression, or you can help dismantle a system of oppression.
You said you're hoping to encourage people to ask the right questions. What do you consider the right questions?
I would say, you know, especially for white people entering into this conversation, I think a question would be is, what is this like for you? How does this impact you? Or simply, am I hearing this correctly? Am I making the right assumptions? A lot of times we assume that because we've read a book or we've seen a movie or we took this class in college that we know what something is like. But lived experience is not something that you can kind of, you know, build through other alternatives like books and movies. And it is really important to go to the source and to do your research and, you know, read what's been written, firsthand accounts from people, and really ask, what do you need? Not, I have read these books and I've determined what you need. But what do you need right now? What are you feeling right now? What can I do to help you?
Let me link your book to the clip that we just played, the Don't Touch My Hair song. You've got a chapter in your book that's titled, Why Can't I Touch Your Hair? Explain the relevance of that to this discussion.
I think it's important to look at the root cause behind a lot of these discussions we have. So often I've been told that, you know, this insistence that you can't touch a black person's hair is somehow frivolous or petty. But it really does come to bodily autonomy and respect. And looking at the history of what black people have endured because of their hair. I grew up being told time and time again that my natural hair was ugly and unprofessional. And I was told to pour caustic chemicals over it that would burn and scar my scalp.
And who told you that?
Oh, you know, society tells you that. Your classmates tell you that. You're told that when you're prepping for job interviews. You know, there was a lot of times where I remember, you know, being told, I remember hearing coworkers being told as well that their hair was too ethnic for an office situation. And people not even realizing what they're actually saying, you know, that you have the hair of a black person and that's unacceptable. And, you know, since the age of probably six, from just seeing the images of every quote unquote beautiful black person had straight hair, I myself wanted straight hair. And that's not how my hair grows out of my head. So I realized by the time I was 29, I didn't even know what my hair looked like. I couldn't remember what the actual texture of my hair was. And so then when you go through all of this effort to break free from this white supremacist programming that tells you that your hair is awful and ugly and unprofessional, and you endure the comments as you grow your hair out and it becomes nappy and kinky and coily.
How do you wear your hair now?
I wear it natural. I do. It's very big. And my stylist keeps telling me that gravity will take over and it will not continue to grow up. But I stand in defiance. I say it will continue to grow up forever. I will have the world's largest afro. It will be glorious.
You go. look, I want to go to the calls. And we've got Charlotte on the line from Baltimore, Maryland. Charlotte, welcome to On Point. What's your question for Ijeoma?
Thank you, John and Ms. Ijeoma. I want to help people dispel the myth of race. We are one human race. And there's a book by Stephen A. Tillett, T-I-L-L-E-T-T, called Stop Fooling for the Okey-Doke, that was written last year, in which he describes the evolution of the term and the action, the myth of racism. It exists. It exists. I'm not putting that down. I'm not minimizing it. But we are one human race. We all evolved from Africa. Even Norwegians have African genes. So we're different ethnicities. That's what we are. And centuries ago, there was no race. There was no concept of racism. People were recognized as individuals. So we really need to go back to that. Thank you.
Ijeoma, is that possible to go back to that?
I would say that if we ever want to get to where we are not discussing race, that means that we have to deconstruct the systems that uphold race and racial oppression. But we can't do it before then, because then we won't be able to accurately, address these issues. Things affect black people in certain ways. Things affect Latinx people in certain ways. Things affect, you know, indigenous Americans in certain ways. And we have to be able to acknowledge that first. If you I get the impulse because it is a construct. But a lot of things in our society are constructs. I've said before, money is a social construct, but I cannot will myself into being a millionaire. And if I do not like our current monetary system, that means I have to change the system. So if we want to get to where we're not talking about race and we are not divided by race, then we have to actually focus on the system that upholds that. And it does mean that we end up talking about race for quite a while more.
I want to take another call. Got Lauren on the line from Savannah, Georgia. Lauren, welcome to the show. What's your question for Ijeoma Oluo?
Thank you, John. A couple of comments. First of all, I think what we're getting as a response from white society right now is more of a defensive mechanism, as in, that really doesn't sound right, and please don't include me in that. And that's the real sense that I get. I think for the most part, the whole issue of race has really been still being avoided on every level. I was just in Savannah. I took a two-hour tour 2 days ago. The entirety of the tour was about white privilege in Savannah, and not a word was said about black society that had to have been the sustaining issue of anything that was happening in Savannah, not only in the past but currently today.
Lauren, what's your question?
It's really not a question. It's more of a statement that the issue of race isn't really a conversation. We have to be motivated to do something about who we are and who, our connection with society. So I guess I'm saying that it's more of race is going to be solved by action and not just by conversation alone.
Lauren, thanks so much for your call. Ijeoma?
I hear a lot of what he's saying in a lot of other people, and I think it's really important. Part of the reason why I wrote this book is because we need to update our conversation on race. A lot of times, conversations on race focus on intention. If you mean well, then you are good. If you mean bad, then you are bad. And when we talk about race, oftentimes we like to focus on people who, quote unquote, hate other people. But race is first and foremost a system in our society. And when we continue to focus on people's intentions instead of the impact of their actions, what happens then is you can't address race without someone thinking that you're talking about who they are as a person. And that's where that defensiveness comes up. But who you are as a person actually has very little to do with it. You can love your neighbor. You can love every person of color you come in contact with. But if you interact with the system of white supremacy in a way that upholds it, you are harming them. And it has nothing to do with whether you are a good or bad person. And part of what I want to do is get people actually talking about how these interactions with the system impact their day-to-day life so that we can find opportunities to make that change. But that means we have to stop thinking of race and racism as just, you know, KKK members riding around on horses and start thinking of it as everyday people who are interacting with a system of privilege and oppression and doing so in a way that upholds that system that harms people. And that means
Ijeoma, on your point, I want to play a little clip of our president talking over the last couple of days. On Friday, President Trump signed a proclamation honoring Martin Luther King Day in the Oval Office. Now, as he got up to leave the room, several members of the press asked him to respond to his comments the day before about immigrants from Haiti and Africa. And a warning, a reporter used a vulgar word that could offend some people, a word the president reportedly used himself.
Mr. President, will you give an apology for the statement yesterday?
Mr. President, did you refer to African nations? Use the word shithole.
Mr. President, are you a racist?
Mr. President, did you add your comments?
Mr. President, will you respond to these serious questions about the statement, sir?
And President Trump defended himself over the vulgarity he used for Haiti and African countries with reporters in West Palm Beach, Florida, yesterday.
No, I'm not a racist. I am the least racist person you have ever interviewed. That I can tell you.
Now, to your point, Ijeoma, about it not being about hateful Klansmen, where does Trump fit into the conversation? Is Trump an... do you see him as an outlier in this conversation? Do you think he's more like most white Americans than they think?
I think that he is definitely playing to the base urges that a lot of white Americans have. We live in a society that says a lot of really horrible things about people of color, both overtly and subversively. And we, you know, need to recognize that. We grow up in a culture that tells people a lot of awful things about people of color. And usually there's a voice inside your head that says, hey, that's not a great thing to think. You shouldn't do that. And what Trump has provided is freedom from that guilt. Saying, no, 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 embrace it. There's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with thinking this thing about people from these countries. And he's kind of giving people freedom from that, you know, nagging sense of guilt over the way in which they have absorbed white supremacy. But he is someone who is working both systemically and personally to forward racism in this country. He is not only saying things that are racist and acting in racist ways, but he's trying to put forth policies that further the oppression of people of color in this country. So he's providing both. He's providing opportunities for people who don't want to be racist to continue to interact in a system in a way that upholds oppression. And he's also providing freedom for people who do want to be openly racist to go ahead and do so without any shame.
I want to go back to the phones. We've got Dee Dee on the line from Columbia, South Carolina. Dee Dee, welcome to the show. And what's your question?
Well, it's more of a statement and weighing in on racism in America and black women, especially in the military, who are still oppressed by the ideology of having straight hair. And I've been in for 18 years, and time and time again, I was told that I need to throw a wig on it or braid it up to make it look, you know, right. And I'm like, this is my natural hair. So I just kind of wanted to let people know that, you know, people are not riding around with white hoods on. They're right here every day. They work with us. You know, they're a part of our group. You know, we're all supposed to be one, and, you know, you're still singled out. So I just wanted people to know that, you know, we're still oppressed everywhere.
Dee Dee, are you still serving?
Yes, I am. I've been in for 18 years. And my hair has always been an issue.
It's interesting because oftentimes people hold up the military as one of the most successful examples of an American institution that's adapted to the civil rights movement and to the principle of everyone being treated equally. Is that not been your experience, or is the issue with your hair emblematic of other issues as well, or is it just that issue?
No, it's throughout. And I got to tell you, you know, moving from Wisconsin down here to the South, it's a little bit different for black people in general. Like you go up north, you don't see many officers that are black in the military or many black people up there at all in a big unit, where if you come down south, you see more prominent black people. And then the hair issue is, you know, it's not as prominent. So, you know, it's not so much a problem. And the military, I mean, it's not just one issue. It's, you know, it's throughout.
Is it still a problem for you, or has it been resolved?
No, it's still a problem. Now, they have made some changes to the policies on our hair, but all the changes that they made to hair, it's about black women's hair. And they made some changes, but they still put stipulations on there. How can you put a stipulation on someone's hair? I think as long as it's professional and if it's in a military cover that you have to wear on your head and it's the right color, there should be no problem. There should be no, I shouldn't be told that my hair is a gray area.
Dee Dee, I very much sympathize with your problem. Thanks for calling. Igioma, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that oftentimes we call these systems a success because of how well people of color have been forced to assimilate into a white narrative. And I think that our military is a very good example about that. And looking at examples such as the way in which women in the military are forced to wear their hair, you know, I think people need to understand psychologically what it's like to wake up every day and have a list of things about your race that you have to hide or modify in order to be seen as professional and acceptable. What that does to your psyche to start your day out like that, and to know that you will be seen as a success, you know, only to the extent that you can cover and hide these things about the way in which you were born. And I think that we need to really challenge what we look at as success in these relationships, because it does not mean that people of color were able to successfully mimic white culture. We need to look at our norms and challenge that. And in a place like our military, that's enforced more than ever.
Do you think that there are other issues that, like hair, that if you step back, that would be looked at as cosmetic things that are also problematic beyond just hair itself?
Yeah, I would definitely say, you know, personal style is definitely looked at throughout culture. It's amazing to me. I've the amount of people who have told me, thinking there's nothing wrong with it, that of course they would be scared when they saw someone walking with baggy pants or a hoodie. Why wouldn't they? They're obviously thugs, as if clothing is intention. You know, we have to really look at the coding behind this language.
Ijeoma, hold that thought. We're discussing race in America. You can join the conversation. Why is it so hard to talk about race? To move past bitterness and misunderstanding toward honesty and justice. I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.
Hello, just dropping in to remind you about Here and Now. We cover the day's most essential news with context so you know the why and what's next. A fast-paced snapshot of the world every day. Listen to Here and Now on NPR One or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, and we're talking about race in America. You can join the conversation. Do you feel the racial divide in this country widening? Can we narrow it? I'm talking with Ijeoma Oluo, whose book, So You Want to Talk About Race, comes out tomorrow. And I want to start this segment, Ijeoma, by going back to the phones. We've got Ron on the line from Charlottesville, Virginia. Ron, welcome to On Point.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
My question is that I believe, do we really feel it's constructive to keep on throwing blankets over all people? And we do. I'm an Italian New Yorker, and when I put a suit on and walking down the street, people have a different impression of me, of the bad group that I belong to. I'm not a racist person, but it seems I almost seem to be feeling I'm into that group the way she's talking. It's all of the white. It's not all of the whites, nor is it all of the blacks, nor is it all of the Black Lives Matter. I think we need to go to the issue, and I think we keep on putting blankets over everybody, and that does create more problems.
Ron, thanks so much for your call. Ijeoma, how do you respond to Ron?
I would say it's important to realize that regardless of your intention, you interact with a system of white supremacy. This really has nothing to do with what you personally think and feel about people of color. Yes, you can absolutely love people of color, but if you vote in a way that upholds white supremacy, if you walk through your day not acknowledging the way in which your whiteness benefits you in certain areas and disadvantages other people, and you don't do something to help rectify that, then you're a part of the problem. This does not mean that you're a bad person. It does not mean that you're a good person. And we need to start setting that part aside and say that if you really do want to live in a world where one of the greatest indicators of your success and health and safety in this country is not your race anymore, then you have a duty to start looking at what is causing this and where you interact with it and start making some changes. And that does mean that you'll be uncomfortable sometimes. And it does mean that sometimes people may not trust you immediately because you've spent your whole life not investigating this. But it doesn't mean that you don't need to do the work. We live our values. We don't just say our values. And we live them not by being passive in a system that will harm people if we do nothing. We live them by seeking out where the harm harm is being done and fighting to rectify that.
Now, I want to read a passage from your book that speaks to some of what I think Ron was feeling. You say, this is not an easy process and it's not at all fun. At times it seems never ending. At times it may seem like no matter what you do, you're doing something wrong. I think somebody like Ron and perhaps others listening to our show would feel that from the way you're describing the imperatives that you see for them.
Certainly. And to that, I would also say, if the worst thing that happens to you is you feel a little bad because of your white privilege, you're having a really great day. Because every single day, the outcomes of life and success for people of color are largely determined by their race. And we don't get to avoid that. We don't get to say it's uncomfortable and it's painful, so we're not going to talk about it anymore, or we're not going to deal with it. Because when I go into a job interview, my race is the first thing people see. When I, even filling out an application, you know, my race is the first thing people notice in my name. When I am walking down the street, it helps determine my safety or not. If I am pulled over by police, it has a lot to do with my general ability to continue living. And we have to remember that, that if you're saying it's too difficult, I don't want to have this conversation because occasionally it doesn't end well, occasionally I feel a little bad, what you're saying is, I'm going to continue to leave the entire burden on actually living in a system of racial oppression on people of color, because we don't get to ever set that aside.
Let me go back to the phones. We've got Lewis on the line from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Lewis, welcome to the show. What's your question?
Thank you. Actually, I have a statement.
Okay.
I am Hispanic. For the last 2 decades, I have been considered of color, and I've been judged as being of color, meaning not white. And that's a pet peeve, because there is a difference between ethnicity and race. I am white. I have 5 children. 2 of my 5 children happen to be blonde, blue-eyed. Just to like group us all into one category is so wrong. And I just want to know what you guys think of that.
Ijeoma, how would you respond to Lewis?
I do think that is something that we really do need to start talking about more, the differences between ethnicity and race, because those same, you know, systems of privilege that work throughout, you know, the broader swath of America actually, you know, continue within Hispanic culture as well. So we have white Hispanic people, we have Afro-Latinos, and oftentimes people are erased and grouped together, but that means that the hardships that people within these groups suffer are often ignored. So Afro-Latinos oftentimes do not exist in our general dialogue around race. You're either Black or you're Latino, right? And, you know, you're either white or you're Hispanic, but people within those systems still suffer in this kind of microcosm of what we see in the broader spectrum as well. And we need to be able to address that and allow people to have their culture and their heritage, and also address systems of race and colorism within these societies as well.
Go back to the phones. Althea is on the line from Watertown, New York. Althea, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Thank you for taking my call. I am very excited by the conversation, especially by Ijeoma. I am a biracial woman. I'm in my 50s and was born at a time when I was probably illegal in 33 states. But one of the challenges or things that I find with racism, as it's noted in America, is that we paraphrase every American. And we do it in every single thing, from registration from kindergarten to every form that you fill out to your death certificate. And I think until we get to the point where we stop paraphrasing, whether you're a Black American or Asian American, Pacific, Hawaiian, either we check all the boxes or we check none at all and move on from there and just treat everyone as an American.
Althea, that's a terrific point, and I think that actually my impression is that more and more people are declining to respond in a binary fashion to that question, and you get more and more people responding to forms without specifying a singular race. Ijeoma, what do you think?
I think that it's important to remember that no matter what, we can't ignore race in society. And a lot of times I think the impulse is if we just stopped seeing it, it would stop being an issue. But race is not only a system of oppression and privilege. It is now at this point a history and a culture. There was a really great study done in China that was taking five-year-olds who had, you know, no firsthand experience with Black Americans, but actually had a lot of anti-Black bias. And what they showed was that by actually teaching these five-year-olds to differentiate between the different faces of Black people, to actually tell them apart and get to know them as individuals just by showing them how to look at their features and their hair and different things like this, that it had a measurable decline in their anti-Blackness that lasted for weeks and weeks. The truth is we actually need to see people's race, but we need to see all that that encompasses and the full spectrum of opportunity and talent and history and culture that comes with that. That's when we start seeing people as human beings, including their lived experience in their race in this society.
We've got lots of calls coming in. Let's go back and take another one. RJ is on the line from Napa, California. RJ, welcome to the show.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call. Very excited for the conversation and appreciate everything that's being said. And I'm going to try to word this properly. I feel for myself, I've always sort of felt this sort of lack of fidelity of white identity. Like white pride doesn't exactly have a positive connotation for me. And I have a lot of admiration for Blackness, but understand how, you know, I can't enter that in certain ways. Although being an American, in a lot of ways, without Blackness, I don't even know what being an American is, because I feel like it's so central to my American story. But at the same time, I feel like this lack of fidelity in the white identity really undermines the progress of race relations.
Well, RJ, let me stop and ask you a question, though, because I understand your point about lack of fidelity, but research has shown that the decisive group of Trump voters in the primaries in the beginning when he was getting started was the group of people within the Republican Party who felt the strongest sense of white identity. And that has been a through line of Donald Trump's support throughout. Is that the white identity that you're talking about?
The white identity that I think that is, all that that white identity is not Blackness, but it's not an identity. That's what I mean. It really lacks anything except not Blackness.
And I see. You're saying it's an entirely negative impulse.
It's an entirely negative impulse based out of fear, and that's what got us where we are and what locks us in. So I'm really curious to the author's thoughts on where does white identity go to try to find itself? Because I feel like, I was born in Virginia, but moved to California when I was 10 years old. And I moved with a Southern accent and from a school that was, mostly Black to an area that had, two Black kids in the school system. And they asked me about the racism in the South, my white teacher. Over there in the South.
Right. RJ, that's a fascinating point. Igioma, what do you say to RJ's point?
I would say that this is a common kind of point of crisis for white Americans who are trying to address race issues in this country. I think, first off, it's important to remember that white identity is everything. It is the default of this culture. But there has been kind of this necessary amnesia about it to not see what that actually is, because there is a lot of harm built into that for other people. And I don't think that your average American wants to see how their culture and their identity is contributing to harm in other people. And when you do see that, that can be an incredibly painful thing to try to rectify. What I would say is, it's first very important to actually look at white culture. And white culture is everywhere. It's in the music we listen to, the art that we, call high art. It is in our history books. It is in our government. It is everywhere. And we need to start looking at that as for what it is. But then recognize that if you do want an identity to be proud of, you can, of course, recognize the certain, you know, achievements and things to be proud of. But then you work towards claiming that identity and saying, no, I have had enough. Whiteness is no longer going to be about oppression and about exclusion. I am going to make it something better. I am going to make it something I am proud of. And I'm going to do that by confronting those who would change it to something shameful, who would change it to something hateful and harmful. And I would say that's the most powerful place that white people who want to confront systems of racism can do the work.
Let's go back to the phone. Samantha's on the line from Omaha. Samantha, welcome.
Hello. Hi, welcome.
What's your question?
I just wanted to comment on, I just had a question on, like, what would you say for people who are just kind of stuck in the middle of everything? Like, I'm a multi-race person. I'm a light-skinned woman, and I've, you know, seen bias on both sides my whole life. On just racism and not always in a really negative way, just more of in a confusing way for some people. Like I've had one of my white friends and her family, her mother said to me once, I don't see you as black. I see you I just don't see you that way, even though I am part black, you know? And I don't think she ever mentioned it in a negative way or hateful or anything like that, but as her own comfortability, you know, that's where she, I don't know, came from. And I, in a sense, maybe wanted to talk about race in a way. And me and my other fellow mixed friend were there. And she, you know, she's like, you guys just don't act black. You don't talk black or anything like that. And that's just a basic stereotypical mindset. And I was just wondering, like, is it, and like for her daughter, that was making her feel awkward. And then that sets her up for getting defensive in a way of, my mom's not racist. She's just confused in a sense of that. If that makes sense of kind of where I'm going with that question, like, what do people do when they're in the middle? I mean, is it, you know, you confront and you can explain your side, because I grew up with my white family. So I'm not saying that I'm not black. I am completely black. That's my race. That's how I was born. You know, it's just more or less the culture and respecting other people's culture and where they come from and who they grow up with and the things that they pick up from them, you know, whether you're white, Hispanic, black, Asian, any of those things. I mean, we carry those traits on with us throughout our lives.
Ijeoma, what do you say to Samantha?
You know, I would say that it can always be tough being mixed race, because you do oftentimes feel like you're stuck in the middle and you are afforded certain privileges due to your lighter skin tone. But at the same time, you are still black if you are a mixed race black person. And I would say it's important when you're talking with people and deciding how you want to move forward. Oftentimes, I find it's most effective to focus on the impact of what was said. And so I like to like boil it up, you know, and say, hey, you know, what do you think black is? You know, you say, I'm not really black. How would you define blackness? And if they say, oh, you know, and I've heard this before plenty of times. Oh, well, you know, I mean, you're not talking, you know, like black people, and you're not going around, you know, you're dressing differently. And I'd say, okay, so if you saw a white person dressing a little differently than someone like here where I live in Seattle, and you saw them dressed differently, would you tell them they were not white? Why are you limiting blackness like that?
Ijeoma Oluo, we have run out of time. Her book, So You Want to Talk About Race, comes out tomorrow. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, President Trump undermines American institutions, says former Republican speechwriter David Frum. He will make the case. I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.